That means, that's in Eastern terms, English terms. That means what we call emunah, that means to arrive at a level where there is a connection, a oneness between one's own consciousness and being, and that transcendent level which one can never grasp with the rational faculties. We try to look at it from a rational point of view, what doubts can do for a person, how one can use them, a rational examination of Jewish history, of scientific observable facts in the world. And last week we tried to look at the area of what's known as Das. Das being the subject of inner wisdom or inner knowledge, which means in mystical terms mystical or transcendent consciousness. That means that there's an area, we won't revise the whole subject, but we want to discuss this evening a development of last week's subject. So let's just place ourselves in context. Don't you have seats? You can't stand up there. Are there no more seats? The place, the tool that the mind has that can grasp a higher wisdom is a tool that can't be put into words. In other words, since these areas of knowledge are completely transcendent, that means they don't have a tangible aspect to them, they don't have words, there are no images or pictures for them, all the mystical diagrams are simply ways, what they call heuristic tools. It means ways of channeling a person's power of abstraction so that you can make a click or a switch into something which you grasp intrinsically even though you can't explain it. And the whole study of mystical science is only a way of trying to trigger that automatic switch which clicks into abstraction but which can never be brought down again into words. So we said it's a very difficult subject to discuss, and if you think that's difficult, tonight we're going to try and look at the level that's abstract with respect to last week's subject. It has to be done. It has to be done. So let's try and understand again where we hold it. We said there's an outer faculty. That's the rational faculty, and it's a faculty that makes contact with the world through the senses. But then we said there's an inner view, an inner eye, what Rabbi Dessler calls a mabat ha-pnimi, the inner view or inner consciousness, which grasps things because they are, not because of any other reason, not because they can be seen or apprehended or proven or measured or experimented on, not because of any of that. Any of that knowledge is scientific, Western, rational knowledge. All important and it's all valid, but it's not where the mystical wisdom lives. But there's a higher area where one has to know a thing over there because one knows it. If you could say why you know it, then it wouldn't be in that category. If you could prove it to somebody or explain why it must be that way, then it wouldn't be that thing itself. Right? Example, the most classical example we tried to fill out last week was the consciousness that a person has of his own existence. Right? You know that you are because you know it. There is no other reason. Right? You don't know that you are because you can prove it to yourself. There is no proof. The oldest problem in philosophy, as we said, is trying to phrase or formulate a proof that can establish the fact that I exist to myself. There is no such thing. We went through various attempts last week to try and show that. But you know that you exist without any question. Right? A healthy, together psyche knows that it exists as its first consciousness. Now, we said last week that whenever you know anything, the first thing you know is that you're around to know it. Right? The first thing that the mind grasps, before it grasps any external knowledge, or even any internal knowledge, the first consciousness is the consciousness that you are. If you don't have that consciousness, you certainly can't know anything else. That's an automatic field through which one has to go in order to know anything else. You don't think about it consciously when you're trying to think, for example, when you're sensing your own existence, like we said last week, in an experience of fear or ecstasy. In either of those two extremes, one knows intrinsically that one's alive. There is no possibility of trying to rationalize about it at that time. But actually, before you know that you are, you know that you know. And the mystics say that even before that, there's another thing that you know, and that's that you know that. And that's the first tenth of inner consciousness. Now let's try and take all this vague ideas and try and put it into something practical. This thing that we call Das, knowledge, inner knowledge, we said last week, is a field that is knowledge that's a connection. Now, when you know something rationally, that's not yet a connection with the thing. When you know that one and one is two, you don't connect with that knowledge necessarily, no more than a machine does. A machine can also know that one and one is two. It can put it together and establish that one and one is two. But then there's another aspect of knowledge, which is where you bond with the knowledge. The fact that not just that one and one is two in the computer section of the mind, but that you actually know that one and one is two. It's the difference between the truth of one and one is two and the observed fact that the printout says that one and one is two. We chose that example, one and one is two, because that's an external fact. But yet, even that kind of knowledge bonds with the inner knowledge. That inner knowledge is where you actually experience the knowledge. The example we gave, if you remember, to try and feel it, for those who weren't here, is when you struggle with a technical problem, like a piece of Gemara, or something in mathematics, or any difficult problem, sometimes you have the experience where you go through the piece of wisdom, let's say the mathematical problem, and each step is logical. Each step leads to the next, and it all makes sense. And when you've finished, the result is proven. But you don't understand it. You're familiar with that experience. But you can go through it step by step until you know it off by heart, backwards and forwards and sideways, and you're totally familiar with it. You could repeat it. And you're confident that each step makes sense and is correct. But you don't have an overall grasp. That doesn't connect with you. Then what happens is, very often you sleep on it. You wake up the next morning, understand exactly what it means. Right? The difference between those two forms of knowledge is that the first form is the rational form. That means it's measurable and you can check up each detail, but it hasn't yet bonded with the personality. What happens during the night is that the extra dimension of knowledge, and it only happens when you stop thinking, doesn't happen while you're thinking about the problem. It happens when you stop thinking. That's the time when the knowledge bonds with you. Now that leads us to the next element of Das, which is what's called marriage. That's where we have to start this week and try and lift it beyond that. The word Das in Hebrew has very strangely got two meanings. It means to know, and it means the intimate side of marriage. Right? That's what knowledge really is. It means the bonding of two opposites into one thing. In the mind, we understand that as being the place where, or the experience, where the outer wisdom, the facts that you know, actually become part of your personality. They actually bond with you. That's the intimacy of a marriage experience. In mystical terms, we have to understand a bit deeper. If you think about it, you'll see that where something bonds with something else, if it's a meaningful bond, then you'll see that a third thing is produced. That's the rule in the spiritual world. Where male and female join together correctly, and that's why we take such tremendous pains in Torah living, that bond should be in perfection. Exactly the opposite of the way the world lives right now. They've taken all meaning out of that bond, all depth and all loyalty and all productivity out of it, using it exactly for the opposite. That's a bond that the mystics say creates dispersion. The way they're using that bond, which is supposed to forge the greatest connection between two things, the way they're using that bond is what drives a rift between two people in such a way that there'll never be a connection between them. That's the way it's being used out there. And unfortunately, it's driven itself into the Torah world, to the Jewish world, certainly, in such a way that it's almost impossible to use that area of life correctly. In fact, most Torah thinkers who give advice in this area say that it's not even worth striving for holiness in this area, that if a person can just be normal in this area doing well, right? But to strive for an experience of holiness in the area is not possible anymore. But it's a connection that you see that if used correctly, there's a third thing that's produced. The nature of the third thing is actually the combination of the first two. What's produced when a connection happens is that two things that were two separate things become one thing. In the biological model, if you want to look at it in the terms of the world, what happens is a child is produced who's actually a combination of the two parents. It's a remarkable thing. It's not that the one is a parent and the other is a vehicle. It doesn't work that way. Both forces, what's called the male force and what's called the female force, they're both joined together in such a way that what's produced actually is a part of both, and it's an enmeshed part of both. It's not a detail here and a detail there. It's actually a bonding of all details. It's a remarkable thing. That is what's called a bond that gives what's called pri, what's called fruit. Yeah? What gives forth fruit. That's what it is. Now, we said that if you think about it, you'll see it fits into many different aspects of Das. If you remember, we pointed out that it's the reason why when a child is old enough to have Das in the mind, they're old enough to have Das in the body. It's a remarkable thing. You know, you're familiar with the fact that in Jewish law, in Torah, a person becomes mature at age 13 or 12, which means that they have the capacity to produce something new in the mind that's binding. Contractual obligations, right, and all other aspects of mature adult living happens at a certain age. What's remarkable about it is that that happens to be the same age when physical maturity takes place. And actually, if you think about it, there's no reason that it has to be so. What is physical puberty, physical maturity, the ability to produce children physically, what does that have to do with maturity in the mind? But obviously, if the marker of the two is the same, if it's the same age at which both happen, obviously one's a reflection of the other. And what mystically we would understand is that when the body is old enough to produce a third thing, the body's old enough to bond with an opposite and produce a third, which is a combination of the two, it means that the mind is able to do that also. Which means the mind can bring down, the mind can bond with something higher and produce something that wasn't there before. And it's that area that we want to look at in detail. Now, the reason we're trying to speak about something that is so difficult, if not impossible, is because it's everything that a person is. Everything other than this experience is not human. Everything else that you experience in life, except for this refined and abstract point that's almost certainly going to be impossible for us to discuss together, but we're going to try anyway, everything else that you could experience in life is not human. Because this is the core and the flesh that creates something new. After this, the thing just runs on automatically. And a machine could have done it, an animal could have done it. It doesn't take what's called human spiritual ability. So we have to be able to focus on an area that's almost impossible, if not impossible to focus on, in order to become what we understand to be human. Let's try. Let's first of all do what's forbidden. Let's take a picture. It's permitted if you use it, only for the right reason. Let's take a picture together and build a model, diagram, and then we'll know where we're talking in the diagram. On condition that we all agree, that we all understand together, that we don't mean this picture at all. We're only doing it as a way to get some beginning of how to think about the subject. But if you think that the subject is a picture, well then, it's definitely, definitely not the right idea. But we're allowed to do it because in order to put it, if you want to put it very crudely, it's the fact that we're allowed to say it in words. Actually, this thing can't be said in words. And putting it in words shrinks it into a completely different world. But since there's no other way to communicate it than to put it into words, so it's allowed for the purpose, but only for the purpose, of being able to switch immediately up into what it means. Similarly, one can make a diagram, but only for the purpose of realizing that it's not the diagram. Are we all together? If you think of such a diagram when you'd be davening, for example, it would be a tremendous prohibition. Right? Tremendous transgression. If a person would daven during prayer, meditational experience of elevation, speak to Hashem and he'd have in his mind even the most abstract picture, it would be a direct Torah prohibition, one of the most grave. Okay? So we're only doing diagrams and words just in order to be able to get a grasp of the reality, no more than we study the body in order to understand, the physical body, in order to understand Hashem's mystical levels. We don't mean that he has a body, we mean exactly the opposite, but we only get to an understanding of that abstraction from looking at the physical world. But you have to be aware all the time, that I'm trying to make it as clear as possible, that you have to click over into a level where all that you witness here is irrelevant, only the tool for the springboard. So let's do it. The diagram that we would use here would be this. It would be the image of a human, of a person. And in the person there would be a right-hand side and a left-hand side. And running through the center is a line called the Das. We mentioned this briefly last week. That line runs through the center of the being, and it's the thing that connects the right and the left-hand sides. That's exactly what it is. It's a connection between right and left. Right being what's called the male, and left being what's called female. This line is a bond. Right? It so happens, if you think about it, that it runs through very special areas in the body. It runs through the place where the skull, the head, where the, as I'll say, the head of a child is open. You know that the skull of a baby is open at that place. So that's where you put your tefillin. In case you think tefillin are just some accidental ritual. Right? Tefillin, which is a special idea of spiritual glow that a person has to reach a level to feel, they go on top of the body at that point. They crown the body at the place where the skull of a child is open. That's where the tefillin go. From there, through the mind, through the two halves of the brain, between right and left, there's a line. It's so abstract that in the mystical system it's not even a point. All the other points in the mystical system, even though they're complete abstractions, but they're described as being a point in the right-hand side of the head, and a point in the left-hand side of the head, and the right arm, and the left arm, and the middle of the body, and so forth and so on. But this is so abstract that it doesn't even have a place. It's just a flow of energy. It's a line that connects all the 10 points in the body together. And it runs through the center of the body, and it runs through the tongue, and it runs through the place where the voice is produced, and it runs through what's called the tongue in the mystical writings is called the Bris Haloshim, the covenant of the tongue, and it runs also through what's called the Bris Milah. The two kinds of covenant that are, they're very hard to speak about. We can't go into detail, but I'm sure with what we are saying you can work out the obvious details. If you consider the tongue, you'll realize that it's an organ of connection, right, in the higher world. The mouth is an organ of connection. I have to speak in hints, but if you think about it, you realize that we have a principle in the mystical system that if a part of the body does more than one thing, and those two functions are vested in the same part, then they must be the same thing. Because otherwise there would have been two separate organs for that thing. If they were two different things, there would have been two different tools for them. And if two things happen in one thing, they must be the same thing. The Gemara has a debate about why you don't have two mouths. The Gemara has a debate why you don't have two mouths, since they've got two functions. A person eats and a person speaks. And the Gemara says you make enough trouble with one, and that's why it was not fitting to be given more than one. But the Gemara is trying to tell you, what it's trying to tell you, is that actually those two functions are bonded into one function. So a moment's thought. Again, we're doing it only at the higher level because it's not a suitable forum to go into it in more detail. It should only be done with men or women separate and then only married people. So we can't go into detail, but let's do it where we can do it. If you do it in the higher world, you'll see that the mouth is a strange thing because it has functions that don't seem to be connected. First of all, you eat with the mouth, right? Then there is speaking, which doesn't seem to be at all connected. And also a universal human experience, which we discussed before, is that the mouth is an organ that's used for kissing, which is a very, very strange activity, if you think about it. What do those have to do with each other? Well, in the mystical system, we could understand that if that's an organ that lies on the center line, which is always the force that bonds right and left, or bonds male and female, so then that must be the place where you see connection made most deeply. And if you think about it, you'll see speaking is a form of connection, right? It's the most intimate form. It's the most intimate form of connection of what's within me with you. To try and convey what's within me to you by facial expression or by means of the body would be much more crude. There's very, very little chance that I would be able to get across anything of subtlety and refinement. But with speech, you can almost share what's in your mind. You can't share what's in the higher dimension, but you can certainly share what's in the external mind with another. Which means that it's an organ of connection. And of course, that's why it says, when Abraham and Sarah, it says that, Es ha-nefesh asher osu b'charon, the souls that they made in Charon. So the simple meaning of the verse is the children that they bore. Souls that they made means people that they made, but it doesn't mean it. It means the students, the people they taught. Which is exactly the same thing. Just that the lower form of connection brings a body into the world, the higher form of connection brings a mind into the world. And of course, that's the reason why a person in some ways has a greater obligation to his Rebbe than to his father, in some ways. Because that's a form of connection that develops him in the higher world. Whereas what the father does is brings him into the lower world, the physical world. So speech is a form of connection. Eating, if you think about it, you'll see, is the most potent form of connection that there is. Because in mystical terms, it's not tonight's subject directly, just going to allude to it. In the mystical systems, eating is as follows. The most intimate connection that there is in the world is between a body and a neshama. Inside your physical body, you have a spiritual being. And the mystics say that if there ever was a male and female pair, then that's it. The most opposite imaginable duality in the world, that's the neshama inside and the body that contains it. It's such an opposite combination that it's impossible that the two should be put together. Actually, it's impossible for the two to live together because they completely negate each other. The neshama inside is a spark of infinity that by definition is abstract and it's of purity. The body by definition is something that's finite and it's impure. Right? It is lowly, it contains excrement. It's by nature a lowly thing from the lower world. The fact that these two should be able to lock into each other is impossible. Right? By natural wisdom, impossible. And that's why the bonding of the two is called Pele. Right? The mystics say that the bonding of these two opposites, always the bonding of two impossible things, the Hebrew name for that is called Pele. Pele means, again in English, it means a wonder, but it means an impossible wonder. And of course that's why when you use the bathroom, you make a brocha, a monthly lasis. When you witness the body, when you experience the body work in its lowest sense, so then we start a remarkable thing. I don't know if there's another religion that has its devotees use the bathroom and then starts to sing it. That in spiritual terms. That's what Torah is. You use the body in its lowest sense and you get spiritually inspired. It's a remarkable thing. But of course the message is that when you see the body work and you realize that it can do this and it has inside a neshama that motivates this, that's a remarkable experience and you can't help making that bracha. Mafli lasos, that means it's an amazing connection between two opposites. And of course it shouldn't take you long to work out that the word pele, if you rearrange the letters, it spells aleph. The aleph, right, is why? Because the ultimate letter of connection is the aleph. Aleph is the letter that connects, and this is tonight's subject, it connects the non-existence, that means the world before formation, the world before the letters begin, connects them with the aleph base. Where does the aleph base begin? You know that the aleph base gets more and more concrete as it progresses. The first letter is the most male, not the most ethereal. The base is already a female element. That's why the world is created with a base. It's already physicality. Gimel Dalet, until Taf is the last letter when everything's total and complete. But the closer you get to the beginning, the more male, the more ethereal, the closer to the point of connection with that which can't be fitted into a letter. And that's why the aleph is the letter of connection. Think about it. It's the only silent letter. That means it has form but no sound. The ayin, by the way, is definitely a letter that has sound. It's one of the five guttural letters. People who speak Hebrew correctly pronounce an ayin. Ayin is the fallen form of the aleph, by the way. It's the tangible side of an aleph. That's why they're so similar, not tonight's subject. But the aleph is the form of connection. That's why. It manifests in the physical world. It has a form, but it has no sound yet. And of course, if you look at an aleph, you'll see that's why the letter aleph is spelt. If you look at an aleph carefully, you'll see it's two yuds and a vav. It's a yud facing down, a yud facing up, and a vav between. Which means the 10 mystical dimensions of the higher world reflected in the 10 mystical dimensions in the lower world, connected together by the letter of connection, because aleph is the expression of the connection of the two worlds. In other words, it couldn't be clearer. If you look at the letter itself, there's no other language that does that. In any other language, a letter or a word is just a conventional grunt that people agree will mean a certain thing, just by convention. Right? That's how far they split off from the spiritual root. But the Loshon Kodesh, the Hebrew tongue, it's not called a tongue for no reason, as we're discussing now. That's why language in Hebrew is called a tongue. A tongue or a lip, Lashon or Safa. Very interesting, very interesting. The word actually tells you what it means. Language is the connection. That aleph is made up of two identical things facing in opposite directions, the high one facing down, the low one facing up, and connected by a straight line. Straight line in Hebrew is above. It's the letter of connection. It means six, which is always the connector. Vav in Hebrew means a hook. Vav in Hebrew, the letter when spelled out into a word means a hook. It happens to be a word that is spelled by two identical letters, vav, vav, which means the letter itself is formed out of two opposites that are bunched, two identical units that bond together. And the word itself means a hook, a means of connection. It's also a straight line because the mystics say that it's what joins the higher and the lower worlds. That's what it is. Of course, the aleph, yud, yud, and a vav adds up to 26, which is Hashem's name. which is the force that connects with the world, the root of what the world is. That's what it is. And of course it goes on and on. The word Aleph means to teach. It means to make spiritual elevation. La Aleph in Hebrew. Aleph means to teach spiritual wisdom. It means to lift to a higher spiritual dimension. Of course, in modern Hebrew, it's been perverted into the exact opposite. In modern Hebrew, which is an attempt, unfortunately, to take the spirituality out of Torah. So today, in modern Hebrew, the word is La'alef klavim. It means to train dogs. That's what it means. But that's exactly the opposite. And from that, you can see exactly what it's supposed to be. From what it's been perverted into, you can see exactly what it's supposed to be. Aleph is 1,000, which is the highest expression in the decimal system. Aluf means a rank that exceeds all other ranks, and so forth and so on. That's what the Aleph is. But that's the idea of the first thing that comes into the world that's a connection. That's what the tongue is. Now, these two things that bond into each other, the body and the soul, these two things are so opposite that in the mystical writings it says that they could never bond together unless they have a special mystical energy. You have to hear this well. You have one opposite, you want to bond it together with another opposite. They're like two magnets that repel. In order to bond them together, you need to force them together with energy. What's the energy? What is the energy that holds two opposites together? In the mystical world, it's called food. Food is an energy that enables two opposites to be held together. That's why it was the last thing that was created, the tenth of the ten sayings of the creation of the world, is the creation. Now that man's been created, the last step is the creation of the energy that holds him into the world. That's what food is. Think about it. If you don't eat, what happens is that the neshama starts distracting itself from the body and you get faint. That's what the mystics say. And if you don't eat long enough, if you don't put that energy in, it snaps away completely. In the mystical writings, the Nefesh HaChaim, it says that similarly the world has to eat. In order to keep Hashem in the physical world, Hashem which is the ultimate transcendence, and the physical world which is the ultimate finite, how do the two get bonded together? Sacrifices. The sacrifices are the food which Hashem eats. You have to be very careful with this idea. That's what it says. It's korboni lachmi. My sacrifice is my bread. And that's why they have to be dipped in salt. That's why they have to be offered exactly like a meal. That's why the altar is called Shulchan Gavur. It's called Hashem's table. That's exactly what it is. And that's why the Beis HaMikdash and the altar is the place where eating takes place. What eating? The spirit, the soul, the neshama of the world eats in order to... Just like a human needs to take in food for his neshama and his body to be joined, so the world needs to take in that form of food for the physical world and Hashem, which is the neshama of the world, to be joined together. You can understand that today, since we don't have sacrifices, we are very faint. Very faint. The two are distracting themselves to an extreme degree. All we have left today to form the connection is davening, tefillah, prayer, which takes the place of sacrifices, and that's our form of connection. We'll try and speak about it also. That's our form of connection. But that's all we have left. Just a few desperate words. That's the idea of food, and that's why the mouth, which is the organ of connection in speech, is also the organ of connection in terms of eating. This will explain to you many things. If you think about it carefully over the weeks and months, you'll find many fascinating things. It's the secret of why when Jews get together to eat, there's a special kedusha. When three people eat together, there's a very, very special thing that happens. We bench completely differently. For eating, it's not you get a minyan together to daven. Three people eat bread together. And it's a whole special benching, which is a mitzvah d'oraisa, according to some opinions. To bench with a mezuman is a d'oraisa mitzvah, a Torah commandment. And when 10 people get together to eat, we start benching with Hashem's name included. It's a remarkable thing. Why? Because eating is the essence of connection. It's the connection of body and the shama together to reach oneness. When people get together and they bond themselves together in the action that is bonding, it's a very powerful unity. Of course, it has to be done correctly. The way we eat today is more of a separation of the human and animal. But the way eating is supposed to be. In fact, it's said that when the Hasidim have a custom, if you think about it, trying to bring out ideas that are opposite to the way we usually think, Hasidim have a custom called a tish. You know what a tish is? The Rebbe's tish. The Rebbe, you know what a tish is? The Rebbe sits and eats and the Hasidim watch. That's what it is. In many places, the traditional Hasidic tish is that the Hasidim get together, usually on Friday night. Many places, the Hasidim, they go home and have Friday night supper, and they come back to the Rebbe's table. They all sit around the table. The Rebbe sits at the head of the table. What do they come for? You think they come to hear words of Torah, to see the shining countenance of a saintly individual. That's not what they come for. They come to watch the Rebbe eat. in many Hasidic customs, the Rebbe takes of his food, and the Hasidim each get to taste a little of the food that's left over from the Rebbe's food. But in many Hasidic circles, they don't even taste the food, they simply watch him eat. Why? Why? Because the Hasidic idea was this, that to teach greatness by teaching Torah, to teach what a human being can be through a great man teaching transcendent, spiritual, amazing insights is easy. To teach what a human being can be by watching him eat, which is what a horse does, to teach greatness and elevation there, that's not easy. And therefore, they dared not eat in front of him. But when you watched a man on a level of spiritual greatness, when you watched him do something as lowly as eating, and you saw the glow and the spirituality of that, that was an inspiration. To hear him say words of Torah, you knew was an inspiration. That was nothing. But to see him act out physicality, the lowest act of connection with the physical world, and to see the glow of that, that's what they came to see. And of course, if you think about it more, you'll see that's why there were people in the Gemara who tried to hide under the Rebbe's bed. Yes, there were Talmidim, the Gemara, a great Rebbe, a Tana, a Moira, found one of his students under his bed. And he said to him, "What are you doing here?" And he said, "It's Torah, I have to learn." That's some of the idea. Now, after developing it this far, it shouldn't be hard to see that kissing, obviously, is something that's done with a mouth. We've said this before, the act of a kiss, which is a universal sign of affection, it's a natural act of a mother for a child. It's a natural act of connection and of affection. It doesn't make any sense logically. It doesn't make any sense at all. You try and figure out what pleasure or what love is expressed by such an unhygienic activity. It doesn't make any sense at all. Nothing logical about it at all. It would have been made much more sense to, you know, grind ears or bump elbows or... You know, there are many things you could have thought of had you wanted to design. But the mystical idea, and that's why it's so universally acknowledged and understood by the human mind, is that in the higher world there's a connection. And that connection is a flow of energy. A direct flow of energy, that's what it is. So we can't speak in the lower world, that's where we're speaking now, but it should be obvious. This line of dust, which is the connection, runs through those organs, and it runs through the other parts of the body, between the halves of the body. It always runs through the line that's connection. In mystical terms, we've discussed before that the center of the body is always the line, the force that connects the right and left halves. The right is the side of giving and kindness, the left is the side of discipline and strength. The bonding, which is the force that enables the two opposites to live together, that's the center of the body. And so forth and so on. You can work out the whole subject, I'm sure, with some thought. That line is called the das. Now, we discussed this and some of its applications last week. Now, what you want to understand as a further step is this. Where does the das begin? If it's a flow of energy, what's its beginning? Let's follow that line up mystically. Let's get to the place where the tefillin are worn. Let's try and understand what is that point. The das is very hard to grasp. You can only grasp it with the das. You can only know it because you know it. But the place where it begins, that's very, very difficult. But let's try. The person begins where he begins. You begin your body at the top of your head. That's the highest point of the physical structure. In the world of consciousness, that's where you begin also. If you could have a model of your own consciousness, of course it wouldn't look like this at all. Again, it's just a very, very coarse and crude way of trying to say something that can't be said in words. But where you begin would be the top of what your being is. We're just allowing ourselves to use this image now. From there, it flows down. From there, the energy flows through the different parts of the mind until it reaches the parts of the body, right? Until it gets expressed. We're talking now not in the body, we're talking in the mind altogether. But it has the same equivalent parts. For example, let's try and make it practical. Let's take the development of an idea. How does an idea grow in the mind? Stay with me carefully. First of all, what happens is you have the flash of inspiration, right? First of all, you have that light that comes on. You have the idea. A couple of seconds of thought, if you're aware of what's happening to you, most times we aren't aware of it, but if you allow yourself to become conscious of your own inner process, you'll see what happens is that as that light comes on, within a few seconds it starts to become organized. When the light first appears, it's not organized. If you were asked at that point to say what it was, you couldn't say what it is. It hasn't yet become defined in its parts. Then briefly, shortly after that, it starts to swim into focus, starts to become clear, and finally, it's crystallized into detail. Those are the three elements of any formation. Again, the transition from nothing to something when the light comes on, then it starts to swim into focus, the transitional phase, it begins to break itself down into tangible images, and finally it sinks and settles into a final finished plan. Is that correct? It's not arbitrary breakdown, it has to be that way. This is the truth of the Kabbalistic system, is that if you're sensitive, you see that it is that way. It's not somebody trying to give an artificial description to something that's convenient, but it has to be this way. And it doesn't need any proof, and it can't be proven. But if you have any consciousness of how you work, that's the way it is. Now, what's easy to grasp is steps 2 and 3. Because there you can actually be aware of what's happening. After the idea has begun, so you see that it starts to become defined. Right? It starts to swim into focus, and you can feel that happening. It grinds itself into a shape, and then you can certainly feel when it's finished. Because when it's clear, you have all the details. Let's make it even more concrete. Let's say you're an architect designing a building. Okay? So first of all, you have a problem. You have to design a building. The architect thinks and thinks and thinks about it, and in a moment of inspiration, usually when he's not thinking about it, suddenly he'll get a blast of inspiration. In that second, the totality of the idea will be clear to him, and within seconds, milliseconds, seconds, it'll start to differentiate itself into a building with floors and walls and doors and so forth and so on. And finally, it'll be clear in his mind such that he can even draw it in detail. Right? He can actually picture and plan and pinpoint each element in the building. It's clear, right? Now, the subject that we want to study together is that first point when the flash happens. The next phase is easy. The next two phases, those phases of the das, what we discussed last week, where you know a thing, that's easy. What we want to grasp this evening is, where does it become something from nothing? That's not easy. Because the problem is this. As soon as you become aware of it, it's already something. Correct? What we want to grasp here is the becoming of something from nothing, what's called yesh me'ayin. When the nothing becomes a something, that's the moment we want to be able to latch onto. The problem with it is that as soon as you latch onto anything, it's too late, because it's there already. So you have to develop the sensitivity, the ability to be able to live in that infinite second when the light flows in. As soon as you have allowed yourself a second, a millisecond, to grasp what it is, you're out of the parsha. Much too late. And it's that infinite interface that makes you human. It's the only place that you're human. And it's the only place that you are you and your personality. Anything beyond that, you're just a machine. Once it's begun, and it's in the mind, the way it swims into focus is just a very mechanical process. With a bit more skill or a bit less skill, you can make it a bit more efficient or a bit less efficient, but it doesn't make you you. You're just a machine that's learned how to knock it into shape, a little bit better, a little bit worse, but it's not you. It's the original idea that you generate that makes you you. That's what makes you different from me. The fact that I might be able to figure out my initial inspiration more clearly to its endpoint than you, or you than me, that's just that my machinery is more efficient or yours is more efficient. But that doesn't mean that I'm a different being than you are. It's what my initial flash is, as opposed to what your initial flash is, which is what makes me and you you. And that's an area you can never experience. Although that's who you are, you can never get there. Because the closest you can get is where there's something already. It should be apparent why it's a difficult subject. And that's everything that you are. And the only way to create yourself and develop yourself is to live there. Any place lower than that, that you live, is not reforming yourself. All you're doing is just learning how to manipulate the pieces a little bit better, a little bit worse. But you never will be anything different than you were before. And of course, most of the world never ends up anything different than they began. They just learn how more skillfully or less skillfully to knock the pieces around and rearrange them and rearrange them, but they never become anything new. And the obligation of being Jewish is that every second has to be something new. At least every day, you have to be something that you weren't the day before. At least every day, if not every hour or minute. Avraham Avinu was able to do it as a constant explosion, a constant nuclear fission. But you have to at least finish each day different than you were the day before. If you sit on your bed at night and you say, what did I achieve today? And you can't pinpoint an area where you opened up a new field of sensitivity or ability, you fail. You took a day of your life that will never come again, and you threw it away. That's what it is. Let's understand. Let's try and study that subject. That point, that's the beginning of the Das, is called Rotzon. Rotzon. That translates loosely as desire. Desire. Which means that it's, we try to refer to this in various ways in the past. Let's try and tie it together in such a way that the Das swims into focus a bit better. The Rotzon is what you want. What you really want at core, at rock bottom, what you want is a Rotzon. And it's what you are. The rest is just how you go about getting what you want. Is that clear? After you've had the desire, once you focus, once the desire is in your mind, the rest of it is just a drive how you're going to achieve that desire. Everything else is going to be just a manipulation of the variables, the people around you, the environment, everything, even rationalize and fool yourself as to how you're going to go about getting that original Das. But you'll never change yourself unless you can invoke a new Das, a new Rotzon. Unless you can have a new Rotzon to want something different than you wanted it before. You'll never be different. And that's your obligation, is to be different. The word Rotzon in Hebrew, if you break down the word, you'll see. First of all, the Medaktikim say that it's based on the word Ratz. Ratz means to run, means movement. It's where all movement begins. It's from the stillness, where the stillness of the unformed moves into being. That transition, that's called Rotzon, where all movement begins. It doesn't take you long to work out that it's the root of the word Aretz, the world. Right? Because the world is a process that moves towards Shamayim. In Hebrew, the word Aretz, which means the world, moves towards what's called Shamayim. The word Shamayim in Hebrew, which means, again in English, it's a pathetic translation. In English, it's called heaven. It doesn't mean heaven. It means the final spiritual reality. The word Shamayim, if you look at it carefully, it spells Shamin, which means there. Everything that it's possible to point to in the final stage and say there, the final tachlis, that's what Shamayim is. Everything else is a way of getting there. That's called Aretz. So the word Rotzon means a movement towards. The gematria of the word Rotzon, if you add up the numbers of the Hebrew word, it adds up to Makor. Makor means the source. An ultimate outflow, a source. Which incidentally means the womb also. The word Makor in Halachic writings, Torah writings, means the womb. And it's no accident, and I'm sure you've already ahead of me, that's why the womb is central. That's why the woman, in the woman's being, right, the word, the concept of the rechem, right, the makor, also known as rechem, the womb, that's exactly central. The word rechem, by the way, if you rearrange the letter, spells machar, which means tomorrow. Because the womb is the organ out of which the future is born. And if you rearrange the letters in the only other possible combination, you get ramach, which is the 248 organs that the body forms, which the body is formed. Right? That's the beginning, it's the beginning of the future, and it's the beginning of existence. All three things are in that word. If you think about it further, you'll see that the word Rotzon in Hebrew, if you add up the letters, it also adds up to Shmoy, which means Hashem's name. Which means that if you can raise yourself in your consciousness to understand what you really want, you've raised yourself to what's called the source, and you've raised yourself to what's called Hashem's name, which is the ultimate source of the world. That's Rotzon. That's where you're supposed to be. Think about it again. Let's understand a bit more deeply. You'll see the following thing. The definition of Rotzon, in practical terms, is that which you want because you want it. You remember we said that a Das function is a thing that is because it is, and not for any other reason? Therefore, the core of the Das, the Rotzon, means that which you want because you want it, and not for any other reason. You want it because you want it. If you want it for any other reason, that's not Rotzon. Examine yourself carefully. Take something you want. Do an exercise in your mind. Take something that you really currently want. Ask yourself why you want that thing. You almost certainly see you actually want it for some other reason. Is that correct? Almost certainly. Why do you want that other thing? Probably for some other reason. Correct? But ultimately, you'll get to a place where you want something because you want it and you can't explain why. Correct? You should do that exercise with everything that you want. You take the thing that you want, ask yourself why you really want this thing, you'll discover embarrassingly that it's just a crude avenue to get you to something else that you really want more. It's producing. What you are, you'll find it's a very, very humbling exercise. And that's what you are. It's not just something you want. That's who you are. Everything else is not who you are. You think that your slickness and your presentation and your outward appearance and so forth and so on is who you are. It's just methodology of getting what you want. But what you are is what you want. It's very, very humbling and very embarrassing, and that's what a Jew has to do. And you have to examine everything in those terms.
And you have to raise yourself to a point where you, what you want is worthwhile. Now, how do you do that? How do you do that? How do you get a new rotten? The problem in mystical terms is this. You can't bring in anything new. Because to bring in anything new, you'd have to go outside of where you are. Let's think about it. Let's make a diagram. You rise and rise and rise in consciousness. Where you're supposed to do this, by the way, is in Dhavanam. That's what prayer is all about. Prayer isn't standing there asking for a new, whatever it is, new model of the same thing you had last year. That's not what prayer is. Prayer means raising yourself so you want something new. You actually at core want something else. Well, how can you ever do that? The higher you go in your Otzon, the more you'll arrive at the root of what you actually are. When you get to that core, you are now experiencing what you are. But you can't go higher than that. You can't step outside of yourself. You hear the problem? You can't step outside and pull yourself up from above. You can't go out. It's like in English they say to lift yourself by your own bootstraps. You can't do that. So how do you bring in something new? That's where the mystical pathway comes in. And that's what meditation is. Meditation. Which is not sitting there mumbling some mantra over and over. Right? So until you become a blank. That's called relaxation. That's not meditation. Right? Emptying the mind of everything that's in the mind is not meditation. Certainly not davening. It might be relaxing. It might be a way of getting rid of your worries and so forth. But certainly not meditating. Meditating means rising in your consciousness till you're aware of everything. Not nothing. It means switching off external mechanisms. That's what it means. Switching off the external rational that stops you from getting to who you are. Stilling that part of the mind. That's what it means. But of course they can't tell you these things because there aren't words for them. So they tell you it means switching off the mind. What it means is switching off the part of the mind that you're familiar with. Most people, that's all the mind there is. But what they mean is to get to a mind that's an inner being. And by stilling the outer mind, you hope that the inner mind will switch on. Now, most people aren't aware of any inner mind, so what happens is they fall asleep when they get to that stage. But the point is to still the outer mind, like we explained last week, that there's a tension and an argument between the two, so that the inner consciousness can flourish. When you get to that point, you experience what you are. Now, how do you become more? How do you want something new? So a minute's thought will show you that you can't. There's no way you can ever generate anything new. The best you can ever do is experience fully what you are. You can never bring down anything new. All you can do is be that. And all you can then do is work out new ways of more efficiently actualizing what it is that you want. There's only one way you can get something new. And that's as a gift from another level. It has to be given to you from above. You have to use the dice until it kisses a level. That's what's called in the mystical terms. Dishmaya va'ara nashku adadi. Where heaven and earth kiss each other. Where heaven and earth kiss. You have to get to the point where the power flows in from another world and you get it as a gift. If you don't believe in that, if you don't, never mind believe, if you don't have emunah, which is knowledge of that level, you'll never have it. Never have anything new. It comes across in many ways in Torah. Maseilas Yesharim puts it this way. He said that there are 10 levels of spiritual development. Purity, cleanliness, spiritual honesty. He goes through a whole 10 levels. When he gets to the 10th one, by the way, in case you want to know where we hold him, in case you want to know, most of the later authorities say that of the 10 levels of spiritual greatness that the Maseilas Yesharim speaks about, that's the basic text of Musa. Anybody wants to study the subject of how you work on yourself, to become a mensch, to become something, to become somebody who reaches any kind of spiritual greatness, there's only one book to study. If you haven't studied that book, you can't start anything else. Maseilas Yesharim, it's called The Path of the Just. But you can certainly read it in English, you have to. At least read it in English. He goes through the 10 stages of self-development. Logical, organized sequence of self-development. Okay? Just to give you some idea, the level that becomes before the first one is mastery of Torah. The level that comes before the first, that is Torah consciousness. That comes before stage 1. Stage 10 is what's called Ruach HaKodesh or prophecy. Right? God consciousness in such a way that the consciousness flows through you to the world as a vehicle of Torah. So if you want to know how far we can get today, there's a debate among the late authorities whether what's relevant today is numbers 2 or 3. Huh? That's where we hold it. In case you think you're going to go home and read Maseilas Yesharim and then come back tomorrow. But nevertheless, we have to know. And in levels 2 and 3, there are 10 levels. And at least to get to the 10th level of 2, or maybe the 10th level of 3, at least there, at least. And he says the following amazing idea. He says, when you get to the 9th level and you want to enter the 10th, and you're moving to that point, and it means your own 10th level, never mind that it's irrelevant to us to get to prophecy. When a person's leading himself to his own or her own spiritual perfection, he uses the following words. He says, that final level is like this. It begins in work and it ends as a gift. But only if it begins in work. Only if you've done all 9 stages to get there as work. Unrewarding. Unproven. And you get to that stage. And then you enter the final stage. And that's the hardest work. That's where the guardians of the path are the most vicious. And they turn you back most forcefully. Only when you get to that level and you struggle through that level with no assurance that you're going to get anywhere, then the gates open up and you have a gift. You know, if anybody wants to experience this, you can experience it in such a crude way that it's obvious to anybody who's sensitive. In case you think this is all very high spiritual talk, anybody who's ever had a good idea, anybody who's ever solved the problem that they thought they couldn't solve, knows that the way they did it was by working and working and working and working. And the more they worked on the problem, the more thankless it became. Is that correct? And when you finally gave up and let it dissolve, the answer came in. Is that right? It fell in from above. Of course, you're so egotistical, as we always say. You say, I worked it out. You didn't work it out. It was given as a gift. That's why we say that concentration, even if you consider it at the basic level of rational thought, concentration does not mean thinking about the answer or the solution. Concentration just means keeping all the noise out. It just means keeping all the interference aside so that you leave the area pure. And then it could fall in. Of course, that's why in Yiddish, an idea is called an Einfall. Isn't that beautiful? What a sensitive language. It means that it falls in. You didn't reach up and get it. You didn't build it. You simply kept the noise out of the way so that you could hear something that you couldn't hear before. In spiritual terms, when a person wants to generate a new Rotson, there's only one way you can have a new Rotson. You have to get to the level where you end and you have to say, Hashem, from here on in, I just want what you want. I don't care what it is. Whatever it is that you want, that's what I want. The only desire you have at that time is to have no desire except what's given as a gift. The only way to get there is complete purity. All you can ever do is clear out the noise. You can't want anything new, because then that's an expression of you. You have to want something that's going to be given from another level. It has to be a gift. And the only way you can get is to purify the receiver. You have to make it so transparent that the light can shine through. The light's trying to shine through. How do you purify it? Why does it say that in Jewish terms, in Torah terms, always, the concept of beauty is transparency? Sarah was the most beautiful woman who ever lived. And it says that one of her names was Yiska. Sacha is the root. Kia kol sachin bayofia. Everybody could see through her beauty. It doesn't say they could see her beauty. It means through her beauty they could see through her. What does it mean? It means that she was so beautiful that when you looked at her, you saw Hashem. The exact opposite of today. Today they desperately don't want you to see inside. They want you only to see the skin. The or, which is Aleph Vav Resh, has become or with an ayin Vav Resh. The ayin, the fallen world that we live in, or with an Aleph, that means light. Or with an ayin, which is the symbol of breakdown, means blindness. Iver. Ayin Vav Resh means blind, means skin. It means the level that stops the light flowing. That's what we've done. But you want to get to a point where the skin becomes transparent. The or with an ayin becomes or with an aleph. Right? That you get back to the level where the light is the word that starts with a letter of connection. That's why the word or starts with an aleph. Because it's where the ultimate shining begins. You have to purify that level so much that the light flows in, shines in. How do you do that? You have to completely negate everything that you are. That's the paradox. Only by completely negating everything that you are, that means there's not one last vestige of ego. That's meditation. Person has to meditate to the level where they completely clarify their ego. I don't want anything, Hashem, only what you want. But I want that so badly, it's my life. It doesn't mean giving up on everything. That's not going to yield any gift. The only gift you'll get then is depression. The person yields. The person yields all desire and makes themselves a blank, all you'll get is depression. You have to want so badly a gift. It's what the mystics call a woman's desire. There's a rotzon called a male desire, that's a desire to give. There's a female desire called the desire to have. A person has to raise himself to the point where his male desire to give to the rest of him turns around and becomes a female desire to receive from above. And have to clarify that so pure that there's no ego left. When there's no ego left, when the vessel is so pure and transparent that it doesn't obstruct anything, then there's a direct connection. That's why the greatest man who ever lived was the humblest who ever lived. Moshe Rabbeinu was honored of Mikol Adam. He was the humblest man who ever lived, so he had the greatest connection with the spiritual world. As soon as your vessel becomes self-important, as soon as you want to put something in of your own, at your own ideas, what you think you want, and you're going to tell him, so then you block it out. The most perfect application of this, and we'll finish with this, is to understand what it means to pray. We, like all spiritual ideas, we've got exactly the wrong end of the exercise. We think praying means strengthening what you want. Why? Because all davening is phrased as requests, isn't that right? I want this, I want this, I want this. All of the davening. You have 19 brachos in Shmoneh Esrei. The first three are Hashem's praises. The last three are thanks. But the middle 13 are just requests. I want wisdom, inner knowledge, final revelation. We ask for all these things. So it sounds like you're asking. I want, I want, I want. You're strengthening the things that you want. That won't yield any new being. Not only that, but the prayers won't be answered. Not the way you want. Davening has to be a situation. The Nefesh HaChaim says the most unbelievable thing. When you sit for the first time, you think it definitely is a mistake. Nefesh HaChaim says that everything you ask Hashem for, what you really mean is you want Him to have it. You want it for Him. Why are you asking Hashem for wisdom? Only because it's what He wants you to have. You don't want it. You don't want anything. That's what He says. You know, what you have to understand is when you phrase a prayer, when you phrase a bracha that says, Hashem, I want this, what you really mean is, Hashem, I don't want anything, but I want to be open, and since you tell me that this is what you want me to have, give this to me for you. That's what it means. Of course, we turn it around exactly the opposite, and we say, Hashem, I want it because I want it. You're never going to grow from that. All you'll ever want is what you want. No more than that. Therefore, davening means raising oneself, and that's the meditation of davening, and that's why the world exists on that connection. The connection today, there's no sacrifices. There's no korban. We don't have a Beis HaMikdash. We don't have that food to feed the world. We don't keep Hashem, the neshama of the world, in the world anymore that way. The only way we can do it says in neshama parim sfosenu, that the sacrifices that once were given are now our lips. That's all. We have to fulfill and perfect and pay the price of sacrifices. Since we've lost the direct connection, the Beis HaMikdash, we have to pay it with our lips. The Beis HaMikdash was the place of connection. That's why, I'm sure you've already figured out from everything we've said this evening, that's why the temple was a place, the Beis HaMikdash, was a place where the world ate, and a place of intimacy between husband and wife. Exactly the same thing. Is that right? The Mizbeach was the place where the world ate, we brought food there, and the Kodesh Kodoshim was the inner chamber where Hashem and us met as husband and wife. What did that room contain? An image of two golden kruvim, male and female. And when the Jews used to come on the Sholosh Regalim, and they used to come to see, to meet Hashem, they used to show them, they used to roll up the curtain of the Kodesh Kodoshim. And the Jewish people used to see an image of a male and an image of a female locked in an embrace of love. Ne'urim zebezeh, that's what it says. Those two golden kruvim were embracing each other in a mystical, right, embrace. That's what they saw. And that was the affection. That was the sign of love. That's how they knew that in that place of intimacy where man and woman meet, that's the Beis HaMikdash when we and Hashem meet. And of course, you see all the applications of this. If you ever wonder why there's a certain nation on earth that has placed its holy place on the place where our holy place should stand, why is that? Why is that? Why has no other nation done that? Why do they place their place of spiritual greatness? Why do they place it where the Beis HaMikdash should stand? Because the Gemara says about that nation that their defining characteristic is that there were 10 measures of sexual immorality that came down to the world, and they took 9. That's a nation that manifests 9 of the 10 measures. You know, whenever it says 9 of 10, it just means that the rest is just miser for the rest of the world. Just stalker. That's all. A bit of stalker for the rest of the world. That's something to keep them interested in. But the actual place where the totality of that level of immorality is manifested in that nation. And that's why they build their place there. Because it's a place of intimacy between husband and wife. That's exactly what immorality means. It means coming in between husband and wife. So that's why they put their place over there. It's exactly what it is. That's how we have to understand what's being done over there. That's what makes a Jew feel the way he feels when he understands what's happening. But nevertheless, the Beis HaMikdash is a place of connection. And of course, that's why the Beis HaMikdash is a place of prayer. Isn't it strange? Why all three things? The place where the world eats, the place where male and female, we and Hashem, husband and wife, meet each other, and the place of davening of Tefillah. Because Tefillah is a place, is a world of connection. That's what it means. It means rising in one's consciousness to a place where the ego is bottled completely. There's no ego at all. And all you say to Hashem is, at this point, I just want what you want. Let me have what you want. Completely clarify and clear out all other rottenness, and want only what his rotten is. At that point, you make a direct connection with the highest level. You make a direct connection with what's called Hashem's rotten, which is the highest level of what Hashem is, if we can even speak that way. His will, his world begins with the rotten, and then he begins to bring it down to the world, and then it connects with the world in a human being who makes that rotten his rotten, so that he manifests exactly a pattern of what Hashem is. Hashem has a desire and he carries it out. The human being has to have the same desire and he reflects Hashem exactly. Not only is an image of Hashem, but he comes part of the same current. The energy, the electricity flows directly through him. But only when he makes himself only part of the circuit. and doesn't try and put himself into it at all. That is an explanation of how doubling, how prayer can work. Because the people that talk about this always say that prayer doesn't make any sense. How can you convince him that you need something he doesn't know already? Doesn't make any sense. You stand up and you say to Hashem, I need this and this and this. Who are you speaking to? You're speaking to somebody who knows already. And he's a loving father. If you need it, he's going to give it to you anyway. So what are you asking? What, are you going to change his mind? You're going to speak and change Hashem's mind? You're going to get there and convince him that you need something that he didn't think you needed before? That's what people think about davening. What people do when they daven, they don't daven, they nag. Asking for something that's not good for you, that you convinced yourself you think you need, but you're not going to convince him you need it. And therefore the mystical writings, the Hasidic writings, they all say that what you're trying to change when you daven to Hashem is not his mind, it's your mind. What you're trying to change is you. Then you could have something new. When you could get yourself to a point where what you want now isn't what you wanted before, certainly he could give it to you. He couldn't give it to you before because you couldn't absorb it. You were so opaque at that level that you couldn't hold it. He's trying to shine the light in, but you wouldn't let it. You keep abstracting it with what you want. But as soon as you get to a point where you could want what he wants, you're not the same person anymore. So then you could have a new rot, and then you could get a new blast, explosion of Shefa. And finally, we understand that davening is the tool through which a person has to open an awareness of what it is that he wants to be. You know, we do it 3 times a day, or a woman has to do it 1 a day, not just because it's some routine homage that you have to pay. That's not what it means. It means that there's nothing more important than that. If you're not going to spend a few minutes every day working out who you are and where you're going, so you could desperately find the most desperate experience that your life's about to end, that you might have lived out 120 years or whatever it is, and you never ever thought what it is that you're supposed to be, and you never generated anything new. You got sent here with a certain amount of tools and kalim and a certain amount of raw material, and you just let it burn itself out. And you never became anything that you were supposed to become. You never even examined what it was you were supposed to be doing. You started driving along a road, you never even read the signs, you know, where you were going. Davening 3 times a day is an opportunity, instead of vomiting it out without thinking, it's an opportunity to stand for a few minutes, 4 or 5 minutes at a time, and ask yourself, what exactly is it that I am? And you have road signs, you have guidelines, specific things to train your mind into understanding that that's what you should be wanting, and wanting for the right reason. So that you constantly readjust. You go through a morning of hectic pace, and the morning knocks you out of line, and it makes you think that you want things you don't want. You come to Mincha, you start reassessing what is it that you actually want. Before you go to sleep at night, you say Shema. You ask, you spend a few minutes working out who it is you're supposed to be. And you have to do that constantly, not just once or twice. Why isn't it good enough to do it once a week or once a year? Because every day you have to want something new. You have to want more of what it was yesterday. It doesn't mean you have to be fickle and change your mind and want different things each day. You have to want the same thing more badly. But you have to want it so much more badly today than you wanted it yesterday that it's a whole new desire. And yesterday's desire seemed like nothing compared to today's. When Avraham Avinu says, Anochi Afar Va'efer, I am dust and ashes. You know what he means? He means that everything that I was until now is now ash. Everything that I was until now. And the next second he ashes it again. And he turns the ash into dust. Dust, afar, means the ground from which seeds grow. You know what that means? We think he's being poetic. He faces Hashem and he's being humble. He says, Hashem, Anochi afar va'efer, I am dust and ashes. It does not mean that. He meant, Hashem, what I'm teaching the world, what I'm teaching myself and teaching the world, is that I take every second of my life, everything that I've achieved, I completely explode it into its elements. I'm left with nothing but the ashes of what I was. And immediately I convert the ashes into a rich earth out of which I grow a new rotzon. And as soon as I have the new rotzon to be higher, to serve you better, to become in connection with you more than I was before, immediately I explode that and I become greater in the same thing. Till he got to the point where not a flicker of an eyelid was without a conscious rotzon. And that's why the Torah says, he lifted up his feet and he went. Who cares what he did with his feet if he went? But it means that every action, he lifted his eyes and he saw. Lifting his eyelids was an act of rotzon. But we have to do it at least every day. If you can't hold it every minute or every hour, but at least once a day. And the tragedy is most of us never ever do it. Most of us struggle bitterly just to cope and just to hold the bits and pieces together. But that's not what we're here for. We promised to meet Hashem on Sunday night this week to talk about the mechanism of how a person discovers what it is that he's supposed to be doing and the obstructions to that. It's a whole subject, how a person begins to work out what it is that he was put here to do, what are the obstructions, why is it so hard to find out. It's a separate subject that we have to discuss then. But at least one has to know for now that Ratzon has to be achieving a level where one has to be so inspired about life that no day looks like the day before. Every day has to be a desire to reach greatness. A burning desire. It has to be that it's your life. Everything that the dais grasps, you grasp because it's your life, like we said before. You have to choose it because that's a dais function. You have to want it because that's a dais function. And you have to be it because that's a dais function. You have to so want that new thing. You have to so want to reach purity that you so clearly shatter all your rationalizations and all your vested interests that they break like glass. They have to be so obvious to you that you are actually just scheming a new way of wanting the same old thing. And that way you reach objectivity. And that's what we have to do. We have to try and change ourselves so that the or with an iron becomes or with an iron.